Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Monster X Radio. It's October 6th, 2013. We got another great show lined up for you tonight. I'm Johnny Bigfoot, and with me is my co-host, Shane. How you doing, buddy?
Doing well, man, doing well.
Yeah, and if that song that we just played was actually our guest's son, Mason Randalls, And he has a Facebook page where you can check out his music, and he lets everyone download his songs for free. So I will post that in the chat room here.
Yeah, very, very talented young man, and his songs are found on SoundCloud, and post a link there to his Facebook page. But he's got, you know, very talented artist and upcoming musician, definitely. But having said that, today's guest on Monster X Radio is none other than the Bigfoot researcher, Derek Randles. Derek Randles has been involved in Bigfoot research for over 27 years, and his first encounter with Bigfoot was in the Olympic National Forest back in 1985. Since then, Derek has worked with some of the best researchers, scientists, and wildlife biologists. Derek is also the co-founder of the Olympic Project, which is an association of dedicated researchers and investigators. Really stoked to have Derek on board with us today. A lot going on with him and in the Bigfoot world right now. And you want to go ahead and get him aboard here, John?
I believe he's live. Welcome to MXR, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
You betcha. I appreciate you playing my kid's song, too, and I'll add to that that he's not only singing there, he plays every instrument, bass, guitar, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, and vocal, and that's a mixture of one of his tunes that he did all by himself and mixed it in the studio. So he's a really, really talented kid. I'm real, real proud of him.
Wow. And drums, too.
Yep, everything. He started out as a drummer, and then he went to guitar, and then he went to bass, and then he's one of those type of people, he just masters everything, and then none of us in the family ever even heard him sing until he was over 20, probably 22 years old, and then he threw that out there, and it just blew my mind. I'm really, really proud of him.
Yeah, I'd say
so. I appreciate
you
playing him, giving him props there.
Oh, absolutely. I joined his little Facebook thing on there and listened to some of his songs and fell in love right away. I was like, man, this kid's awesome. He's really got it going on.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that, Shane.
Yeah, there's a lot of feeling and passion in the music. I listen to all of it a lot, too, and I really like that song we just played. I like some of the other ones, too. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So, anyway, thanks a lot. But nice to be with you guys. Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. So, how's the weather up there, Derek? I know down here in Oregon, we got a nice day going on today, but this is our wet time of the year. It's getting into me. So how's the weather up there?
Well, today is beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm fighting off a cold, so I haven't been able to get out and enjoy it too much. And I'm sitting here this morning watching my Seahawks lose a really tough fought game to the Colts. And, man, I thought we had it. But weather's beautiful. Been raining like crazy, though. Definitely summer is over here in the Northwest, and fall is coming in like a lion.
It's the same down here in Portland, Oregon. It's just beautiful day today, but, we've had so much rain lately. Made it kind of hard to get out, but not too difficult. You know, no snow here yet or anything like that in some of the areas that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's the same in Minnesota. It's cold and rainy.
Yeah, Minnesota's pretty drastic weather place, isn't it?
Yeah, you ain't kidding. We're hunkering down for a seven-month winter.
But, Derek, I wanted to start out talking about the Olympic Project just because, you know, I've gone up there to visit you and joined you on the Olympic Project one of the days that, you know, weekends that you had it, and I was blown away personally and was amazed at the organization and who was involved and just the, you know, I'm coming up there thinking, you know, I may learn something. I may not. I'll get to meet some, you know, some people that I've been wanting to meet for a long time, researchers and whatnot. But I was blown away and learned more than I thought I would. And so, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about the Olympic Project and maybe some future happenings going on there?
You bet. Well, it's basically just a group. Everybody's voluntary. None of us get paid to do any of this. It's just, it's a group that Rich Germeau and myself founded a few years back. And what it started out as basically was just a camera trap program. And Wally Hursom offered to basically put as many cameras in our hands as we could deploy successfully and monitor successfully. And basically we started out with, I don't know, maybe 10 cameras, and then it grew, and then it grew, and then it got to over 50 cameras, and we started recruiting people into the Olympic Project, and we were trying to kind of handpick some of the people that I've worked with in the past, the John Bendernagel and John Mayanchinsky and Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who kind of sits on our advisory board, and just basically trying to put together a good team of like-minded people that are all in this, in what I, for what I call the right reasons. You know, just basically trying to get the science down and to learn, you know, study habitat, do what we can do. So it's kind of shifted since it was just a camera trap program to a study. And now it's a study. There's a couple different areas that we're studying really hard currently and trying to learn as much as we can about a particular area, not really jumping all over the place, but sticking to a couple different core areas, documenting every piece of everything that we can find in each area, and then, you know, accumulating and compiling all this data, and then it starts to create a pattern after a while. One of the things that we went over in one of our first meetings on the expeditions this year, I think, Shane, you were there, was, in my opinion, there's just a giant hole in Bigfoot research, and that's proper documentation. So we're really, really running along those lines right there. And this last year, we started hosting expeditions. And there's not a lot of money in expeditions, but there's a lot of information in expeditions. There's a misperception out there. I've heard all kinds of different things that we're just making all this money and all that. It's really a joke. We host up to 20 people. We bring those people in. We just shove what we know down their throat, basically. We take them out in the field. We do our tracking. We do our, you know, we teach how to DNA forensically gather materials. We teach wildlife, or not wildlife, but wilderness survival. Track casting, just a myriad of things, and we've tried to make these trips as big learning trips as possible. And we just try to shove a lot of information right up there, and then we go out and do it with you. We spend a lot of time in field, and that's pretty much it in a nutshell. We are planning some more expeditions, probably starting March next year. We are going to do some snowshoe trips this winter from our research base camp in the Olympics. For right now, the expeditions are kind of calmed down, but we will start up again full force probably in March. And what we're trying to do is to take the researchers that come to these expeditions and make them better researchers. We're trying to teach them everything we know, and we've got a lot of very qualified people there doing so, and with hopes that those people can go out and do their research and share their data with us, just so we can eventually have the biggest ball of information we can, and then start to develop predictability and patterns. So that's pretty much what we're about.
Nice. Is your research focused primarily in Washington then, as far as the trail cam setups go?
As far as the trail cams, yeah. We do have 3, possibly 4 cameras in the Sierras. Paul Graves, one of the members of the Olympic Project, has some cameras over in the Wenatchee area in the eastern Washington side. But the majority of our research is done right here in the Olympics.
Okay, nice.
And it's not even just the trail cameras. So there's a lot of sound recording going on, like, you know, I was a part of that.
Yeah, great point. David Ellis he actually helps me run the Olympic Project now. My co-founder, Rich Germeau, has stepped out of it. But David has stepped up, and David is what I consider pretty much an audio expert. He's got quite the elaborate setup, and actually that setup is deployed right now at one of our sites. And he's got, I'm not even going to begin to try to explain it because it's over my head.
Yeah.
But he has all the programs. We can do continuous recording with very sensitive equipment, and then he has programs to where he can sit down and look at the different voice signatures and all the sound patterns, and he knows how to differentiate this from that. And we're getting quite the database of vocalizations and sounds. So that's a big part of what we're doing now as well.
Yeah, when I was up there, he actually recorded a lot of anybody that wanted to step up that was, you know, felt brave enough to make a call or a sound, you know, call blast or whatever have you. He was recording those to put in his database so that he could differentiate the different, you know, separate those from what might be recorded on there. You know, Cliff Brockman did one. I forget who else did one, but I did one myself, and he you know, recorded that so that he could, if we're on the field doing, you know, calls or whatever, he could tell what was what. And I thought that was super.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. And then that way, especially when you have an expedition going on, it's a lot easier to weed through what is and what isn't. And so, yeah, I think that day, that particular day, we did it on a few expeditions, but on that particular day, I think there was five or six of us that got up there and put ours out there. And then he can store that right in his database and compare it to anything that comes up in the future. So, and he is just really dialed in as far as being able to tell what's what and pulling these sounds apart. And like I said, especially with one of the sites we're working with right now, we have accumulated more audio, I think, than I've heard in my entire 27, 28 years of research just within the last month. It's amazing. And David's pretty much on cloud nine at the moment.
To me, that's some of the best evidence is the audio.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything that makes a noise has a sound signature, and there's a certain, like I said, I'm not going to try to explain it, I'll sound like an idiot, but there's a certain set of hertz or megahertz or whatever that everything has its own signature. And once, with these programs that he utilizes, and Paul Graves does this as well in the Olympic Project, but I've been working a lot more hand-in-hand with David recently, it's amazing what can be pulled out of this audio with these programs, and how you can take, you know, 5 days worth of audio and just sit and look at it in QuickTime and pull things out and then analyze what you pulled out. It's just, it's really cool. Really cool and really informative.
And James Million's still helping you out, right?
Yeah, James is my partner in the guide service, Ridgewalkers Unlimited. And James and I do other things besides Bigfoot research. You know, we're both avid hunters. We're both kind of ADHD right now because deer season's a week away. So we're both just kind of, we lose our minds about this time of year. But, yeah, he's still very much involved. He comes on the expeditions, and the expeditions are actually presented by Ridgewalkers Unlimited, which is our guide service. And the guide service, we do wilderness, off on and off trail backpacking. We teach backpacking. We teach wilderness survival. If groups have a certain area they want to be outfitted into, either on foot or on horseback, we do that. If a small group or a big group just wants to go anywhere and just have a wilderness experience, we outfit that and do that stuff. But it's actually working really well with the Olympic Project, having Ridgewalkers come in, and you know, we take care of the guide part. And James is also an instructor, a wildlife instructor, and he's very good. And yeah, so he's still very much active. We just haven't, we've kind of stepped back here in the last 2 or 3 months and focused on the research, and we haven't had any expeditions for a few months. But like I said, we'll be rebooting again probably in March.
Well, I got a story about James. Just the last time I was up at the Olympic Project, I want to let people know how good this guy is at observation. I was pretty deep into some of the – I was pretty deep in the forest. I was probably 20 yards away from Dr. Meldrum, and we were walking like in sort of a grid pattern. I couldn't see Meldrum, but I knew he was around. And I was creeping out there, and I stopped, and I was very still. I didn't make a sound or anything, and I could see the path off to my right, probably about 20 yards away, and I heard somebody jogging down the trail, and I just stopped and waited to see who was coming. Someone's jogging down the trail, and off to my right, I see James Million jogging down the trail, and he passes me, and I'm like, oh, he didn't even see me. And about 2 seconds later, he backs up, and he looks to his, you know, right, and looking at me, and he's like, oh, I thought I saw somebody standing there. And I was buried in this brush. I could not believe he saw me. I mean, I was just amazed that he's in almost a full sprint jogging down the trail and sees me. And I was like, man, that's impressive. Blew my mind.
He is impressive. You wouldn't want to be a deer. You wouldn't want to be a deer he's after during deer season, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And, you know, the cool thing about James and I, we met in 1991, and we started right then and there, probably within a month after us meeting, he started doing research with me. I was doing a lot of research in the Blue Mountains, and that guy and I have been, I would say thousands, probably thousands and thousands of miles together in the wilderness, and he's about the most qualified woodsman you're ever going to meet. We spent a lot of time together, and two very like-minded people. But we hunt together, we fish together, we hike together, we do research together. We've been, most people think we're brothers. Matter of fact, we were asked yesterday by a cop at a road stop, if we were brothers. It's pretty hilarious, but I guess we spend enough time with each other, we talk like each other, and so on and so forth.
Nice.
But yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's definitely one of the type of people that if you ever find yourself in a spot out in the woods, he's the guy you want there. Because he'll get you out safe and alive and fed and warm and dry.
Nice. So what got you started in Bigfoot?
Well, 1985, I've always been an avid hiker since I was old enough to hike, basically. And in 1985, myself and two other people were doing a hike up out of Lake Cushman, and we had plans of doing some off-trail stuff, and our final destination was, I think we were going to try to end up in Enchanted Valley via Home Sweet Home, which is 14 and then 20-some-odd miles. But we came up, we were about 9 miles up, long story short, about 9 miles up on the staircase trail heading towards Home Sweet Home, and it was getting late. And we decided to go off-trail and go up and make camp off-trail. That way the next morning, if we wanted to explore around, our stuff wouldn't be sitting right there near the trail if any other hikers came by. And I'm not going to bore you with this whole story. But basically, we got up the hill and started making camp and started getting rocks thrown at us. And it was during that episode right there. I was 20 years old, 1985. It was August. It was in the evening. And it was just about getting dark, and we started panicking, running down this ridge, not really having any clue what was throwing rocks in our vicinity, good-sized rocks. And I stopped long enough to get a .357 out of my backpack and look back, and that's when I saw it. I saw one, and there it was. And it shifted my life. It just rerouted my life right there. My life did a big, you come to a T, and I went left. And that's how it started for me.
Is that where you grew up then, Washington?
Well, I lived in Bremerton, Washington. We moved from California, and I moved into Bremerton when I was 10 years old. And my dad was an elk hunter and an elk hunting guide, so I was thrust into that life as soon as I was old enough to carry a meat pack. I was packing elk quarters out of canyons and stuff for people. And
you knew what Bigfoot was. I mean, you're probably real familiar with it growing up there, huh?
No, well, yeah, I knew what it was, but I didn't really ever give any thought. I hiked all the time. Everybody knew, you know, in this area about Bigfoot. And I think we were on a road trip when I was super young, and my dad had bought me, which I've recently found, actually, which is really cool. There's three books, and I think they were all three written by John Green, and they're paperback, and they're pretty big, but they're not real thick. And my dad had bought me one of those books, and so I read part of that book on one of our road trips, but that was the only information that I'd had about Bigfoot. That was probably when I was eight or nine years old. And I never really, you know, assumed that it was real. I didn't even really give it a lot of thought. I had been out in the woods with my dad since I was just a little kid, and I'd seen just about every kind of animal you can see out there, bear, elk, deer, you know, coyote, everything that's up here. And so I never really thought about Bigfoot in a realistic fashion until it happened to me.
I forget the name of the show. Was it Monster Quest, right?
I don't know if I was ever on Monster Quest. They might have had some footage of me on one of them. I don't remember. I think the one you're talking about is Monsters and Mysteries in America, the one that
they're
there.
Yeah, sorry,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they kind
recreate
of
my initial thing. They do an okay job, but it's not real accurate. So actually, right after it came out the first time a few months ago, I made a lengthy post on Facebook to make sure people knew what the exact truth was. They got a few things wrong. They were super nice people to work with, but I like to make things very accurate, and I like to stay very truthful about everything. So I made a statement after that first one came out, but they basically got it right.
Nice. Is that the one encounter you've had then?
No, I've had more. I've been around them on a few occasions. I've found a lot of tracks in my career, in my research or hobby, I guess you could call it. I found over 300 tracks. I've documented 18 track lines, and I've been around them. I would consider myself being around them probably about 9 or 10 times, fairly close. I've had 2 sightings in 28 years, and done a lot of DNA gathering and whatnot.
Nice. What is it with Washington and Oregon? I mean, when I was growing up in Minnesota, Bigfoot was just this faraway creature that lived in the Pacific Northwest or in the Himalayas. You know, we didn't, until the internet and, you know, all these shows, I had no idea that they were in every state.
Yeah, and I don't even know if they're in every state. I have no idea. I get asked all the time my opinion on back east, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Arkansas. But you know what? I have no knowledge of what's in those states because I've never been to them. I know I have good friends. I have good friend researchers all across the United States, and a lot of these people, have had their own encounters in these different states. But I personally can't speak to it because I haven't had any personal experience there in those states. So I just don't know. I know they're here, though.
Yeah.
I promise you they're here.
Yeah. With Oregon and Washington, it's just got so many factors. I mean, the perfect situation almost for a creature like this to survive and thrive in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
Are your winters somewhat mild?
Yeah, well, especially here at sea level. You know, the coastal range in Washington and Oregon, from the top down out to the water, I mean, the whole coastal range is... We have very mild winters here. We might get 6 inches to a foot of snow, but it's usually gone in 3 or 4 days. It's the perfect environment to support, a big primate like this. There's massive cover. If you fly over this area in a plane, your jaw drops. Just all the mountains and the valleys and the trees and the ridges, and it's crazy. And so the cover is thick. The food is plentiful. The water is everywhere. And, you put those three things together and you've got a great living and, sustainable environment. And so it's absolutely perfect for it.
Yeah, I know you guys have the thick coniferous, pine tree coverage there, kind of like we do in northern Minnesota, which I'm sure is key in winter because I can't see Bigfoots hanging out in deciduous areas while all the leaves are off the trees,
Yeah, we do have a few deciduous areas, but predominantly it's Douglas fir, western hemlock, and western red cedar, and there's some pine. Most of the pine is in the eastern side of the state, but it's just the Douglas fir forests here they're immense, and just the Olympics alone, not to mention the entire Cascade Range here, it's immense, and there is just so much territory there. The really cool thing is if you're up in the Olympics and you're off-trail hiking, you're virtually, every day that you're up there doing that, you're in a lot of places where nobody's ever been. And it's very intriguing to hike there, and there's, a lot of aircraft that are missing up in those regions and things like that have never been found. It's almost like the forest just swallows them up. It's if I needed to go hide, there'd be no doubt where I'd go.
I don't think people can even fathom, unless you've been there, how immense these forts are. And like you said, you can go to an area where nobody's been. It blows my mind. When I went up to and joined you with the Olympic Project, it blew my mind just the area, how vast it was and how thick. And, it was like a rainforest. It was just so thick. There was, who knows what's out there? It just blew my mind.
Shane, we only experienced a little tiny speck of it. That's the crazy part.
Yeah, I know. It dropped in a bucket.
Right. So it's cool. And the problem is your life's over before you get to explore everything you want to explore. I'm 48 years old, and I tell you what, there's a lot more I want to look into. So I'll probably, God willing, be doing it into my 90s if I live that long.
Well, I'll tell you what, Derek. Keeping up with you is a hard task. You are in shape. You guys just were like hiking maniacs. I could not imagine going hunting with you or something of that nature. That'd be awesome. I might take you up on that.
Well, the thing about Bigfoot research, Shane, is people, there's a lot of drama, a lot of controversy, and quite honestly, a lot of bullshit going on. Can I swear on this show?
Yep.
A lot of bullshit going on in the Bigfoot world, and the best medicine is just to get out in the woods, and we're out in the woods all the time, and
amen.
It's a way of life, and it's fantastic, and it's about the best thing you can do. And Bigfoot research is such a blast because it is such a tall order. I mean, deer hunting is my passion, and like we were talking about James earlier, it's his passion as well. Sasquatch hunting is another hunt, but we're hunting for information, and it is the hardest quarry that you could ever possibly go after. So if you have a hunting mentality or an adventurer mentality, then it's never boring, it's never dull, because it's the tallest order you can make for yourself. And it's a blast. Bigfoot research is so much fun.
Until
you turn Facebook on.
Yeah. Facebook's such a joke. Absolutely. I can't, you know, the more I'm on it, the more I hate it.
Yeah.
The more I want to get out to the woods and just, you know, if I see something or hear something cool, you know, just being out there in these remote areas, it's just such a joy, and everything else beyond that is a plus. You know, it's just
right.
Get out there and enjoy what, you know, is provided for you, and, you know, be safe and all that, but just enjoy it. Look at your surroundings. Look what you've been blessed with out there, and, you know, I go out all the time, and, you know, I don't always encounter anything or sounds or see anything or find anything, but I can sit up on a ridge looking down at a lake or just the vastness of the forest and just be like, wow, I'm so lucky.
Right, and I'd like to say, too, Shane, that it was a pleasure having you out there, and I got a lot of respect for you as a researcher. I hope that we get to spend some more time together. We got to make that happen. So I think you got your shit in one bag. And so you gotta find time to make it back up here this next year.
Oh, well, I really appreciate it, Derek. Like I said, the pleasure is all mine. You know, the Olympic Project, like I said, it just blew my mind what you could organize and just the amount of people that could get together from all walks of life, all sorts of researchers, and just be on the same page and enjoy, you know, enjoy the company and enjoy, you know, we could sit around and just talk about, it wasn't always about Bigfoot, just different things in life, but a lot of it, you know, the Bigfoot subject was just hearing other people's opinions and their ideas and their research and their experience. I mean, to me, it was just, I'd live there if I could. It was just that great. I was just blown away, and you really put on such an event that it was just mind-blowing to me that I left there, you know, giddy as a schoolgirl, just unbelievable.
Well, the thing that really got to me this year after the different expeditions was just the caliber and the quality of people that showed up on these, and, you know, you make all these new friends, and, you know, we had three or four public expeditions this year and a few gatherings as well, and I tell you what, there was not a bad apple in the group. They were just some of the coolest people, you know, that we continue relationships with, and that is one of the best things right there. And it's so neat because people come in from, like you said, all over the country from different places, and you don't really know what to expect. I got my chihuahua's freaking out here. I can't even find him. But you don't even really know what to expect, and then all these people show up, and they're just so damn cool.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes for a great event. It makes for a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there was people from Idaho, I think, to New Jersey, and not one of them left there dissatisfied. I mean, in fact, they left there just rejuvenated and just ready to go out and, you know, with a lot of knowledge. And like you said, the biggest problem in doing, you know, going out in the field and stuff is the lack of documentation, the proper way of, you know, documentation and stuff. And you guys really just brought it down, put it on the table, said, hey, this is, you know, this is what needs to be done if it's, you know, to be taken seriously. And you gave forms out, you explained them, you know, and you wanted people to give back feedback wherever they're at. Doesn't matter if it's Washington, Oregon. You wanted
mm-hmm.
feedback so that we
That's
could
right. You
project.
Had people from all over the country come out there, huh?
Yeah.
And the kit that Shane's talking about was actually originally designed by David Ellis, but then one of our newest members of the Olympic Project, a guy named Tom Baker, designed, I think it's about seven or eight page documentation form. And if I can touch on this real quick, this is pretty important in my opinion, but the thing with documentation is if you have a core area, what we're really trying to accomplish, if you have a core area that you know they're there, you know it's active, you've been hearing the vocalization, you've been finding the tracks, there's a sighting history there. If you can take that and you can work that for a few years, that one area, and work your working hypothesis in this area, and you gather every piece of evidence you can find. If you find tracks here, you document the day, the time, the weather, the moon cycle, everything about that track, what direction the wind is going, everything. And then you find another track 2 weeks later. You do the exact same thing. You note the elevation. You note the time. Everything that you can describe about the circumstance around what you found. And then you find hair. You document everything you can around that. Okay, then you hear three whoops on Wednesday the 22nd or whatever. You document what time it is, approximately what elevation it's coming from. Long story short, if you keep this documentation running in your core area, after a while, patterns develop. when patterns develop, you can actually start being dependable. What's the word? Predictability. You can actually work predictability into it. And I think, you know, with the way that a lot of some of the great apes were studied, they had to be studied like this in order to make them predictable. Once something is predictable, you can more effectively study it. And like right now in one of our core areas, I've got a pretty good handle on where these things are going to be found, at what elevation, what time of year, and coming up with some good theories on, you know, why they're there. And there's some stuff where, you know, it's just really concrete at this point in some of our core areas. So it's just trying to establish predictability so you can effectively study what you're trying to study. And that's where the documentation comes in. And documentation is boring. And it's one of the things, and when we start our expeditions, when we're doing our orientation talk, you know, the first thing I say is real Bigfoot research is not made for TV. It is, to the normal person, it's probably pretty boring because it's tedious, it's time-consuming, you're out in the woods a lot, you're wet, you're cold, you're tired, and it's really not exciting and finding Bigfoot crazy or anything. It's just, it is what it is. It's not made for TV. But if you keep doing it and you keep repeating it, then patterns start to develop. And then with any luck, you can start establishing predictability. So that's what the whole documentation thing's about, and that's why we're pushing it so hard.
That's awesome. I'm all about the documentation. Thomas, I remember, asked last week, Shane, he asked Tim if they took field notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Tim kind of explained they do videos and they do certain things to document it. But, yeah, because there's going to be things that you might mark or write down that you're not going to think that much of, but down the road you'll be able to correlate it with something else and you make
exactly.
those connections.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah, between Derek and Cliff Brockman, those two really have taught me a lot about the documentation. You know, document, document, document. There's nothing too small or too large that you can't document. I mean, every little detail, you know, the wind, what the animals were doing out there, you know, just every little detail, document it, you know, especially if you find tracks or have an encounter or something. Why were they there? What were they doing there? You know, every little detail. I mean, the more you document, like Derek said, you find a pattern, especially if you're going to an area constantly. You know, not necessarily habituation, just going to an area habitually, you will, if they're there, you know, you will get a pattern, and that's what we need to do, period, is nail down, you know, patterns. And from patterns, you predict, you know, predictability. And you know, I know that's
and
what
it,
Derek
it's a big time saver, too.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And when you have such a vast area and you have limited people, it's nice to know that in November I know to be looking at certain elevation, you know, rather than looking all over the place. And it actually brings up your success with finding tracks and finding evidence. It's just the way to go. It's really the way to go. And working with Dr. Meldrum, you know, he's a stickler for documentation. I remember when I started working with him back in the mid-90s, how, you know, he was just, you know, I was just green at the research end. I wasn't really green, but he was like this rock star, and I couldn't even really talk straight when I was around him. He was my hero, and he just shoved it down my throat. You know, you got to document everything. And then David Ellis with the Olympic Project is a giant stickler on documentation. He shoves it even harder than I do. But it's just, you know, if you're going to study something, if you're going to take the time to study it, why not be as effective as you can, as effective as you know how, and get the most out of it and learn as much as you can. So that's why we push that so hard.
One of the questions that came through in our chat room is, what is the best sighting you have ever heard of and can you describe some of your other sightings or encounters?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know, it's a tall order.
That's a really tough one. Rich Germeau, my former partner in the Olympic Project, had what I would consider the perfect sighting. And the reason I say that is because he was on duty as a police officer in La Push, Washington in 2000. And for those of you out there that don't know Rich, Rich is, I don't even think Rich is capable of lying. He is one of the most honest, straightforward people I've ever met in my life. And he is also a trained observer. He was a SWAT team member. He was an investigator on the police force. and quite the effective law enforcement person. Well, while he was heading down to La Push, one of the beaches in La Push, pretty close to Three Rivers Resort, up there, he was driving his car, his squad car, and he had one run in front of his squad car. And this is the type of sighting that makes a researcher salivate, because it's a policeman with the perfect record. It's a trained observer. So he gets things out of that sighting that your average person wouldn't get, you know, because he's trained to pick things apart when he's looking at people or suspects. And he had one run virtually right in front of his squad car, across the road entirely in front of him, and into the brush on the other side. So that one is stellar, you know. And
what part of the country was that in?
Right up here, right here in the Olympics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then Lindsay Broughton is a member of the Olympic Project. She introduced Rich and I about, I would say, 6 years ago, and it was cool for Rich, because he had, you know, being a police officer and everything, he faced a lot of ridicule when he told people what he saw. So he had been wanting to get in touch with me for a while, and I'd wanted to talk to him for a while. So she introduced us, and we hit it off. And once I got to know Rich, man, he's just one of the most honest people I've ever met in my life. And so to me, that sighting really sticks out in my head. And I have thousands, so that's a really tough question.
Yeah, no, tough question. I was going to mention,
we had another question.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead, John.
From Thomas sent me a message. He's wondering if you have a list of things you check when going out, like do you have a form, or, you know, do you chart the moon phase, things like that?
Yeah, pretty much all the above. We have this documentation, and one of the things about documentation is it is just as important to document when things don't happen as it is to document when they do happen, because then you have that record. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I document every hike that I take, but if I'm out actively doing research, I write it down. I write down where I was, what time, what the weather conditions were like, what I found. Even on camera checks, I'll write it down. When we go, I just did a fairly significant camera check a week and a half ago, and I put some of those videos up on Facebook, as a matter of fact. I document all that. I don't document every time I hike, because I do a lot of leisure hiking as well when I'm not... Even, you know, research is always researching, but I do a ton of hiking. It's just hiking. But, yeah, I do try to, and pretty much the people in the Olympic Project try to keep that going.
Nice.
Yeah, I was going to mention real quick, though, that the area that you guys chose to, the property that you have host the Olympic Project on, it was chosen specifically for a reason, and you've told me this before, about the number of crossings and sightings, you know, that have been seen there.
Yeah, it's a unique place. And there's a lake up here called Crescent Lake, and it's west of Port Angeles. It's kind of right in between Port Angeles and Forks, Washington. And on the west side of the lake, you climb this hill, and it's called Fairholme Hill, and there's really no habitation there, no houses at all except for this particular place and for miles. And the Salduck Hot Springs turnoff is right there that actually goes back into the interior of the park, back to the Salduck Hot Springs. But at any rate, once you get past the lake, you go for a couple miles, and then the highway levels out, and Aurora Ridge drops down right there, and the Salduck Valley dumps out right there. And the cool thing about it, logistically, is there is a trail there that actually goes up and over the ridge that we're facing, which is Mueller Ridge. And it's the easiest way over the ridge. And there's also a very large power line that crosses the highway right there and goes all the way over the top of the ridge, and it goes almost to 4,000 feet. And then it drops back down to the saltwater on the Straits of Juan de Fuca. So anyways, a few years ago, I got a road crossing sighting that sounded really good. And I always screened. I took a lot of sightings for many years, and I always tried to pre-screen as much as I could before I actually put gas in the tank and the key in the ignition and headed out there. So I pre-screened it, went out, and it was a road crossing sighting right by this place within a quarter mile. It was a quarter mile before you get to it, right when you top the hill. And I interviewed the guy in depth, hiked the area, and actually found tracks the next day on the Mount Mueller Trail. And so, you know, again, documentation. You document that, and then it wasn't very much longer, there was another road crossing sighting about a quarter mile past this place, and documented that one, went out and investigated it, spent time in the area. And then there was a gal named, I think it was Leah or Lila Camacho, who was living in Forks, Washington, commuting to Port Angeles every day to go to college. And she called in a sighting. This is when I was working with the BFRO. And this sighting was in the same spot, except that it had crossed right over onto, right in the ditch right next to this particular property. So, you know, put three and five together, and, oh, my gosh, this is definitely a crossing. You know, this is a travel corridor. Well, Wally had made a trip to Washington about a month later, and I drove him around the entire Olympics. It's an all-day procedure. And as we were passing this place, I said, hey, man, if this place ever, it's the place sits all by itself alongside the highway, and it's right at the base of Mount Mueller. And the Mount Mueller loop trail actually touches the back of this place, so it's very unique property. And I mentioned to Wally, I said, man, if this place ever comes on the market, we have to buy it. And lo and behold, about 3 weeks later, I was on my way up to CQ, Washington, driving by, and there's a real estate sign in the yard. And we bought it that day. So that's where we run our expeditions from, and that's where we do a lot of the – that's where I do all my personal research from, is right there.
Yeah, the location is fabulous. I mean, when I went up there, I was kind of blown away, the access and the accessibility to so many, you know, so many locations that it was just mind-blowing. It's really just a perfect situation up there.
It is. It is, and it's just, man, the problem with that place, though, is you go up there and you don't want to come home.
No, you don't.
It's just
so
cool. You know, you got the lake there, the Salduck Hot Springs. You've got the 14-mile hiking trail that touches the place, and Mount Mueller comes right up out of the backyard. So it's the type of place you can wake up in the morning and drink your coffee and put your backpack on and disappear.
Just go.
It's just killer.
Yeah, that's what Cliff Brockman did. He arrived at that area and threw on his backpack. I think he was there 10 minutes and was already hiking out in the middle of nowhere. Just that good an area.
Yeah, Cliff's been there a bunch. He feels pretty at home.
Yeah, yeah.
he's got his own campsite.
But did you, Derek, want to touch up on a little bit more of your recent activity? You mentioned some of the audio that you're taking. Is there anything else that, I mean, without giving up locations, just some of the stuff that you guys have been doing lately?
Yeah, I'll touch on it real lightly. We'll be making a full report on it and making it available to the public for whoever is interested pretty soon. So I can't, give away much right now, but I will tell you that we're in the middle of an investigation right now that is probably the hottest that I've been involved with since I started my research. The audio coming is ridiculous. The people involved are fantastic, and I think that we have a lot of potential. You hear that from a lot of different people all the time, but this place could yield more evidence and information than maybe anything I've been involved with. So I'm very excited, and unfortunately, that's about all I can talk about right now, because the problem is, if we start talking about it, then all of a sudden the location is going to come out, and then it's going to be overrun with Bigfooters.
Yeah, that's
right.
Fair enough.
Nothing quite scares Bigfoot out of an area than a bunch of Bigfooters. So,
yeah.
One thing I will say, though, is we're doing things a little differently. The people that are involved are conducting the majority of the research. We're just working with them almost in an advisory role. We're doing audio work for them, and we're doing some thermal stuff, but very low impact. One thing that we've learned the hard way, myself personally and a bunch of people that I work with, if you get an area that is very active and you get out there and you start hiking around it every day, putting cameras up and spreading your scent all over the place, pretty soon your really active area is not an active area anymore. And so we're kind of got a new approach when it comes to working with witnesses. Habituators, or whatever you want to call them, just a much, much lower impact, and lo and behold, activities continuing on daily. So we're very, very excited, and hopefully I'll be able to talk about it more soon.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
No, look,
you live and you learn.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, like Bart, Catino, he's in the same, with his research and stuff, people are like, well, when are you going to release certain things, this and that? And these guys, like Bart, it took a long time to release certain things with his thermal imagery and stuff like that, because, if you just throw it out there, you're not really doing anybody any service. You know, you got to.
You're correct. You're
yeah,
correct.
You got to back. You got to back it up. You got to do your homework on it. And you know, it's a long, tedious. Like you mentioned before, it's a long, tedious process to really fathom and come into you know, really do your research on it, and so that it, when it's released, it's legit and not just like a hash pass. Oh, here you go. You know, like so many things you see on YouTube or on Facebook, people just throw stuff out there like, oh, here's a Sasquatch or here's this and that. And there's no science behind it. It's just a mere throwing it out there.
Right. And that's one thing about Bart, you know, and Bart is in the Olympic Project as well.
Yep.
Bart is a very, very close friend of mine, one of my best friends, as a matter of fact. And he does it the right way. I'll put it that way. When he puts something out, he doesn't just put crap out there. He has it completely. He's from one end to the other. And a lot of people could watch him and learn with how to present evidence and how to take, you know, the painstaking time that it takes to do the comparisons, to do thermal comparisons and this, that, and the other thing, and then document it and write it all up professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fabulous at that, for sure. I got a lot of respect for Bart.
Oh, same here. Absolutely. I mean, between you and Bart, I mean, I have the highest respect for you guys just because how you guys go about business. It's not about the fame or the glory or making money off it, because, I mean, really there's none of the above. It's about
right.
documentation and providing that and then letting people look at it and, you know, go, wow, these guys really went out of their way to pick apart what it is, you know, and not just throw it out there and say, oh, absolutely, this is it, or just put it out there prematurely. And like I said, I'm between you two guys, especially, you know, being associated with each other, it's a pleasure hearing tidbits here and there, but when you guys actually come out with stuff, I know it's been a process, and sometimes people get impatient with that, and that's just the way it goes. You can't be impatient with a scientific process. If you're going to do it the right way, it's going to be a long time. You know, people are asking questions here and there about when you're going to release this, you know, your latest findings and stuff. Well, sorry, folks, it's not going to be dropped at, you know, a hat. It's going to be done properly so that people realize that you're doing it properly and that you in fact, can go back and show that you went through the process of, doing it the right way.
And if you don't, then it's a double-edged sword. If you just put stuff out there, it's going to be annihilated before you can get a chance to put your follow-up opinion to it. I mean,
yeah.
People pick stuff apart and tear stuff apart so fast, why subject yourself to that, you know? And I get emails all the time about the Olympic Project website. Yeah, the website's there. No, I haven't updated it, and there's a reason. You know, I'm not going to just keep putting pictures of bears and deer and elk and cougars and everything up there, you know, just for exercise. That's when we have something that is very worthy of being looked at, then we will update, you know, that website. And it's not for entertainment. I get people that email me angry, you haven't updated your website in 6 months or a year or whatever. But you know what? It's not there to entertain anybody. That website is there just to basically showcase what we do in the Olympic Project. And when we have something that's compelling, that's irrefutable, that is definitive, it will be up there. And, you know, I do share my research and what I'm doing kind of on Facebook and some videos and pictures and things like that. And that's good enough. You know, we are certainly not out to win any contests, to be everybody's entertainment or anything else. It's just what we're doing is research, the science part of it, the infield part of it, and like I said, it's not made for TV. It's just,
yeah.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Someone had a question in the chat room earlier. They were wondering why we don't get any good trail cam pics, or really any at all of Bigfoot, you know, when we get all these other animals on there constantly.
Well, that's an easy answer, in my opinion. There's not that many Sasquatch out there. it's pretty clean cut and dried. There are probably some trail camera pictures that are on YouTube that are authentic. I don't know which ones. You can't tell. This is in 2013. You can fake anything with a picture. So
yeah,
it's, you know,
true.
Camera is not going to be definitive. It's going to be great to learn from. Great, you know, crystal clear pictures, especially in succession, would be fabulous to be able to study. But these things, these critters are incredibly aware and incredibly intelligent. And in my opinion, they move like they're in the military. They are hyper aware and hypersensitive of their surroundings and their situation in the woods. And at trail cam, stuck to a tree out in the woods, is probably they're going to pick it up way before it picks them up. You know, unless they get careless and walk by it at night before they have a chance to see any IR glow or anything like that. And the fact that there are just not that many of them running around, that's not a stretch to me at all. You know, I still do active camera work, and a few people in the Olympic Project are still doing active camera work, but we know it's a tall, tall order to get a good picture of Sasquatch on a game camera. You can take 50 cameras and camera trap a two-acre area, and you're not going to get everything on those cameras that live in that 2 acres. It's not going to happen. Well, you take something like the Olympics alone, which is 100 miles by 100 miles square, and then you throw 40 or 50 cameras into the mix, you know, do the math. You're just not going to just go out and get your Sasquatch picture.
Exactly, Derek.
Stop us from trying, and we're trying.
Yeah. No, I like to refer to Bigfoot as like the ninjas of the forest. I mean, they're stealthy. You put something in their environment, that's foreign, they're probably going to avoid it. Mm-hmm. But they do make mistakes. And I've seen a few of your Trollcom pictures that are questionable.
I thought they were perfect.
Interesting. Well, yeah, a lot of people like to say they're perfect. But, and everything makes mistakes. And are inquisitive as well. And I've seen a couple of trail cam pictures that Derek has that are questionable. You know, you don't really know, but they're questionable.
I've got a whole collection of those, actually. Shame a lot you haven't seen, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure I haven't.
I have a ton of them, but until I can put a picture out there that I can say, this is definitively a Sasquatch, then you're not going to get that picture from me. I could put a whole bunch of what-if pictures out there, but I'm not going to do it, because then you're just subjecting yourself to the venom and all the hatred and the bullshit on Facebook and in the blog.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Why go through that? There's other things to do.
And that's why I appreciate, you know, you're one of the guys I look to a lot, because you don't just throw little tidbits out there of just crap or just maybes or whatever. You know, you actually like, well, it could be, it could not be. You know, I'm not going to post it because it's not going to further the research. It really has no, you know, and you know that.
That's right. That's why I'm not continually posting game camera pictures on our website. Just to keep everybody happy, I'm not going to do it. And we'll do it when we have something that's worth putting up there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Cliff Rockman's in the same boat. You know, I've seen a couple of times some of the trail camera pictures that he has that are pretty badass, I mean, to be honest. I mean, just pretty badass and hard to explain. And he's broken it down and explained it and what he believes is a Sasquatch. But he's, you know, it is questionable at best. So, you know, it's not out there in the general public, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cliff has a stellar attitude about it. He really does.
Yeah.
He's just, he's got a stellar attitude, for sure.
All right, John, do you want to take a quick break?
Yeah, we'll take a top of the hour break here for a few minutes, and we'll be right back with more from Derek Randles, and we'll open up the phone lines as well.
We'll be right back.
back with more with Derek Randles. And it looks
Derek,
like
still
we
there?
Got a caller.
I'm still here.
All right. Got a caller?
Yeah. 406, you're on MXR.
Yeah, hi, Derek. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
No, I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, I had a question. You probably going to be asked this, but the Dyer thing. What makes you have an open mind as far as Dyer goes? Do you think he's got anything at all?
Well, you know what? I have an open mind when it comes to everything, and I've made it my career to try to get along with everybody in this field. I base my relationships with people on how they treat me. He has gone after a lot of people that I work with and that I associate with. You know, maybe he has his reasons, maybe he doesn't in some cases, in a lot of cases. But the fact of the matter is, I've been friends with Rick for a while, and he's always been, other than one time, he's always been very respectful to me. And most of the times that I've talked to him, we don't even talk about Bigfoot. We've talked about family and activities, this, that, and the other thing. So you know what? I explained it to somebody the other day. If there is one shred of one possibility that this is real, then I'm there. It's really that simple. And, you know, some people look down on me for being willing to go. But you know what? It's a trip to Vegas. I love Vegas. I used to go there with my mom all the time. I'm not going to be standing up making a giant statement on what I might see or might not see. At this point, it's personal. And he's invited me out there for this gathering, and I'm going to go. And it's really just that simple.
That's good enough. All right, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you very much, Derek. And thank you for
being
involved.
So, Derek, if you go out there and don't see what he's promised, what's going to be your reaction?
At that point, I will probably go hit the slot machines. I'll probably go to Gilly's, listen to some good country music, ride the bull, do whatever. Vegas is a fun place. I mean, it's a win-win trip.
If you want to ride a bull, go to Toby Keith's bar. That is a fun time.
I haven't been to that one yet.
Oh, yeah, you got to go.
I've been, honestly, I used to take my mom to Las Vegas five or six times a year. I love that town. Wouldn't want to live there, but I like to visit. And I actually spread a lot of her ashes there.
I was just on the radio for a second. That was awesome.
Hey, you're still on the radio, buddy.
I got him off.
Okay.
Anyways, it's just Vegas is it's a good time no matter what, and that's the way I'm looking at it.
Is he paying your way out there?
I don't even know. I haven't even covered that. He did say he was at one time, but I don't, you know, it really doesn't even matter. You know, December,
yeah.
Las Vegas, that's win-win.
December in Las Vegas. I might have to join you, Derek.
you'd be absolutely amazed at the people that would like to join me.
Yeah, I could imagine.
People that would not admit it openly.
Yeah, well, I'll admit it. I go out there just for the heck of Vegas. I love Vegas. I used to live in Southern California. It's a 5-hour drive for me.
Right. I hear you. But, you know, it's just Rick's always been, you know, he's always been pretty straight up with me. And actually, when he did that thing with getting Culls down to L.A.,
yeah,
for that thing, he had told me and veered me away from that. He said, do not come. You don't need to be part of this. He goes, the real thing is going to happen in December, and don't want you down here for this. And he had also told me that he didn't want to bring me down there until he was guaranteed that I could get in and see whatever it is he has. So I don't know. I really don't know. But you know what? I'm going to go.
Yeah.
I'm going to go because I've been invited, and that's it. And there's nothing more political about it. It's just that's what it is. I've had a dialogue with Rick for a long time, and he's invited me down to Vegas to see something, so I'm going to go.
Well, if say, you know, it pans out to be a bad thing, besides, you know, playing the slot machines, you know, hope you win some money, but is that going to end your relationship with Rick or not?
Oh, that's a good question, Shane. You mean if I get down there, it's bullshit?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. Probably.
Yeah.
At this point, you know, Rick and I have had, you know, some pretty deep talks. And I'm not saying this is this or that is that. I don't even have an opinion, to be honest
yeah.
with you. I really don't. And there's a really good chance that I'm just not even going to talk about what I see when I go there, because I don't want to put up with the firestorm. I'm not going to get involved in the bullshit.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to. But,
that's,
you know,
that's
the way
thing.
I look
that's...
at it right now, there's a guy that's invited me to Vegas to see something, and if there's even one shred of one remote possibility that it could be real, then why not go?
Yeah.
You know? And if
no,
go down there and there's nothing there to see, then I will enjoy myself in Vegas. So you can bank on that.
That's the thing about you, Derek, that, you know, you take so much heat for your even knowing Rick Dyer. And, you know, I've defended you a few times. Not that it was needed, but the thing is, you don't badmouth anybody. If they treat you fair, you treat them the same. You don't badmouth anybody. That's the one thing. You're such a gentleman and just a great all-around guy that when people question you, it gets me a little pissed off because I'm like, well, have you met the guy? Have you sat down and talked with him? Have you called him? You know, whatever. No, no, no. But they'll badmouth you regardless. And, you know, my personal – I'll be honest. My personal opinion of Rick Dyer is pretty bad because he's treated me bad personally. But, you know, I respect you for that, the fact that, you know, you're just an honest guy and a gentleman, like I said. You know, you treat everybody how they treat you. And,
I try to.
Yeah,
I try to.
Really,
you know, my mom
drove
that into my head while she was still on this planet. And, you know, I ain't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and the halo's not always over my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I do try to treat people with respect, especially in this field. You know, there is enough bullshit and infighting and political crap going on in the Bigfoot world right now. I am not going to add to it. You know, I'm just going to try to get along with everybody and leave it, you know, live and let live. That's just the way I roll.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of bull crap going on in the field, you know, we got questions aboard here on the chat, and I've got some private messages. So give us your download on the whole Melba thing, because you did provide her with some fantastic samples, and so have many others. And it was a huge disappointment for many of some of her conclusions and how she went about doing her, you know, the process of, you know, relaying these samples on. What are your thoughts there?
Whew, how much time do we have?
We got a little while, man.
Well, I got a lot to say.
Yeah, I could
right now I could really take the low road, and I'll take the medium road.
Yeah.
I'm pretty pissed, to be honest with you. And here's the thing. You know, when this study started, we got in very early and started submitting samples to it, and I buddied up with her really, really, really tight.
Yeah.
And so did Rich Germeau and some other Olympic Project people. And she faced, you know, but let me start by saying this, okay? I am very appreciative of the amount of effort that this lady put into this study, okay? And I also know, and I can tell you straight up, that she took a lot of bullshit from a lot of people for a long time, okay? That being said, and the other thing that I'll say is I still have high hopes that some of her data can be used, and I hope more can be learned from it. And I have high hopes for the 30 or 31 samples that the Olympic Project submitted. As of late, and as of some things that have happened, you know, within a year, pretty disillusioned, bad taste in my mouth. There's some crap going on and some lies being spread around that, you know, I won't stand for it, you know, basically. So people have been asking me, and I just kind of got into it with Scott Carpenter a little bit on one of the groups. And the thing is, there are some things that her camp is saying about Justin and Bart that are simply not true. Okay? Yeah, just simply not true. Okay? Bart is not a hoaxer. He's not a fabricator, and he's damn sure not a liar. And I'll tell you what, a lot of people don't like my association with Justin Smeha either. And if you don't like that association, unfriend me on Facebook. Don't talk to me. I personally don't give a shit. Justin is my friend.
Yep.
Bart is my dear friend. And neither one of these guys are liars. Straight up. Okay? And I know that everybody's wondering about the sample and did Bart and Justin actually send in a piece of the original to Trent University in the lab, the criminal lab in Oklahoma? And yes, the answer is yes. It came off the same piece. Okay, I know this. Okay? Mm-hmm. Also, what I will tell you, which is the truth, is, and for whatever her motivation was, I don't even care, but it is the truth, Melba did try to persuade me to have Justin destroy the rest of his sample. Her reasoning at the time, to me, was that nobody else, whoever else tried to study this sample or who tried to run tests on it would not know how to do it effectively, and they would come up with a different result. Those words came from her mouth, along with her telling me how to tell Justin to put a little bleach cocktail thing together to destroy the rest of the sample. And that's when my red flags started sailing. And I said, you know what, Melba, I won't do that. I said, I just won't do that. It's his. I'm not going to tell him to destroy what's left of his sample. And so for all of you folks out there that are listening to this that think there are a few that are trying to vilify Bart for coming out with this information, you're wrong. Because that Bart and Justin did send a sample from the original piece. And I tell you what, Bart had every motivation to have that sample come back matching Melba's, because Bart did get thermal recordings up in the same spot, and that would have helped solidify and validify what he got up there. Bart had every reason to hope that Melba was successful and that these samples matched up. It just would have put more concrete on top of her study. So I'm just going to say, you know, straight up, Bart's not a liar. And I haven't seen anything that Bart has printed that's been a lie or a fabrication. And I can tell you what, there wasn't anybody on the inside of this study any deeper than I was. I was her biggest supporter and cheerleader for years.
Yeah.
And so when these people come on, and I'm hearing all these people talking about this and this and that, and there's just so many inaccuracies, and there's so much bullshit. I know what was going on. I was on the inside.
Do you think you'll get your sample back? I know that I noticed you requested
I blogged
it as well.
No, I don't think I will. And basically, I did sign over the study rights of that sample to Melba, so she's not doing anything illegal by continuing to study it. But I'm quite sure I won't get anything back. It's gonna all have been used in the study or whatever. The thing that pissed me off, and the thing that's even got me to say anything, because it's hard to get me to come out against anybody.
Absolutely.
I'm just not that way. But I started asking for the sample back over 6 months ago. I talked to Melba directly, and I talked to Robin, I don't even know Robin Forrest people, whatever her last name is, her Melba's handler, for lack of a better word. I had instructed them to please send what was the remaining part of my sample, sample 26, the Sierra sample, back to Wally Hersom. And then Wally was going to pay to have it redone. Okay? What is the harm in that? You know, what is the harm in trying to replicate science? To me, it's the only responsible thing to do. If you're going to do this genome and then come up with this theory, this human hybrid notion theory, and I don't know if she's right or not, I really don't know, but what is the harm in trying to replicate it? That's how science is done. That's how science is verified, through replication. And I just wanted the sample back. Well, I was ignored for 6 months. And you know what? I took so much shit for that woman for years and stood up for her for years, and literally was her biggest cheerleader for years, for her to sit and ignore me for 6 months when I asked for what's legally mine back. And it pissed me off. And, you know, I'll get over it. There's bigger fish to fry. And legally, she has the right to study it, so I can't just demand it back. I did give her the study rights. So that's what's going on with that. Now, I'm quite sure there's other questions waiting about the Ketchum thing, and I'll shut up about this.
No, but, I mean, why do you think, because it's pissed me off too, why do you think she has not given you back a sample or at least given you a straight answer?
Well, when she had first asked me, urged me to have Justin destroy the rest of the sample, I asked her why, and she said she really didn't have a great answer other than she didn't think that anybody else that was going to take care of it would be able to test it and run it and have the same results because of the new techniques that she pioneered or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of scientists do want exclusivity in a discovery. Okay? A lot of scientists act like that, not just her. So I kind of wrote it off. And, you know, but I wasn't going to urge Justin to do something like that. And she also spoke with Justin directly, and this phone call is recorded, about him destroying the sample. So for Scott Carpenter or any of these other people coming out of Sasquatch Preservation and this thing and the other thing, you know, don't bury yourselves any deeper, folks. The phone calls are recorded. You know, I have no reason to lie about this. I have, through the Olympic Project, we have 31 horses in this horse race. I want the study to succeed. I've always wanted it to succeed. But you know what? The truth is the truth. And
truth's in the pudding. I mean, period.
Yeah, it's right there. So, and, you know, all that being said, you know, if there's more can be learned from it, great. If Melvin's wildly successful, great. Whatever. But don't spread bullshit, and don't accuse Bart Catino of being a liar about this, because he's not.
Yeah. Well, with Scott, though, I mean, he's still out there building up this, saying her work's legit, that everything that she's done is legit. And I have a hard time swallowing this. I'm just, you know, to me it's, how can you defend somebody that's gone about doing things the way she's done?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of mistakes were made. You know,
I think
a lot of mistakes were made with this. And if you want to see a good model, in my opinion, a good model of how this should be done, look at Brian Sykes.
Yeah.
You don't see a ton of people talking shit about what he's doing.
No,
he
that
kept
was the
it
question.
On the down low. He hasn't gone on the Art Bell show to talk about this and start teasing people. He hasn't been leaking information. He hasn't been doing this. He hasn't been doing that. He's doing it as a professional. And it's a damn shame. Here's what pisses me off. We have, you know, all, and I speak as for all the submitters in this study, there was thousands of hours put into gathering these samples and a ton of time. And then in my case, I mean, a trip to California, cheerleading and defending Melba for years. You know, just handle it right. You know, just handle it right. Keep it on the down low. Get your study done. Get it published, and then put it out there without the drama, without being, you know, having these knee-jerk reactions to what people are saying on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, dear God. It just got infuriating after a while. And
it made the whole thing unscientific, but all the comments made on Facebook and this and that it kind of made the whole thing a joke, and I was like, oh, crap, here we go again, you know, another
yeah.
You know, social site spitting out this crap, and I'm like, wow, they have legitimate samples that are, you know, possibly Sasquatch, and this is how they're releasing it?
Right.
Yeah, now
you
they're
know,
delaying the documentary because of other hoaxers and all the haters going after them and the, you know, and finding Bigfoot, they say is giving them a bad name. I'm like, if you got the goods, you got the goods.
Exactly.
Right. Well, it's the perfect dictionary example of shooting oneself in the foot. You know, and
yeah.
It's a shame because there's a lot of people that had a lot of time invested and involved to help put this study together. Yes, Melba did the footwork, okay? A lot of this stuff, though, was outsourced out, blind studied out to different universities and forensic crime labs. Hopefully, there's still a bunch of, you know, genetic information there that can be useful, and maybe some more can happen with this. You know, I have a problem with that. Like I said, we have a lot of horses in this race. I would love to have seen it successful. And then, on top of that, the thing that really, just the icing on Derek's cake, was I was supposed to be at that press conference in Texas. In light of everything that's been going on, I wouldn't have gone. Because I've been pissed. And
but you were not even aware of that. It was,
but
it
damn,
was kind of
an invite would have been great. You know.
Yeah.
You know. Thanks for the 2 to 3 years of support. Thanks for urging the main benefactor, Wally Hersham, in to keep funding this project. You know, and that's the other thing that's pissing me off. All the news reports that are coming out right now, with the exception of one that I've seen, they're all saying that Adrian funded this whole project. Let me tell you something. Wally Hersham funded the lion's share of this project to the tune of over $450,000. But he's not being talked about here.
Not even mentioned.
For whatever reason, which is beyond me. You know, Adrian and Melba fought through the whole procedure, and it was never even understood if Adrian was going to be part of it because him and Melba couldn't get along, period. And trust me, I know I was there on the inside.
Yeah.
Okay, I spent many nights sitting here on my phone, just like I am right now, talking with a very distraught Melba over all the crap that was going on. And I felt for her, you know, big time, legitimately, sincerely. And, you know, to have, you know, if there's anybody here that made a giant contribution, it's Wally. You know, but every newscast I've seen in the last 2 days or whatever is said, oh, funded by Adrian Erickson. Well, yeah, Adrian did fund some of it, but Wally funded the lion's share of it to the tune of close to $500,000.
Well, Adrian didn't even look happy during that press conference. I mean, he looked like he was out of his element and just he did not want to be there, in my opinion.
Well. Yeah, well, I think you're right, you know, good. And the thing that just irritated me is the group that I co-founded was responsible for almost a third of the samples in this entire study, and I had to find out about the press conference when I looked at TV, looked on the TV and saw Rich sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have nothing against Rich. Rich is a fantastic researcher and a really good person. But just the fact that it was just done so secretively because I have lost favor with Queen Melba, you know, it just irritated the piss out of me.
Well, like I've said before, I never jumped on Melba to begin with. I thought she had some, you know, with the samples and whatnot. I just think she went about the whole thing the wrong way, and then tried to push this evidence forward by creating basically her own journal to pass it, and that really just hurt. I mean, it set back so much research. It set it back years. They made a joke about the thing.
Right. And, you know, there's some, you know, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but one of the other people sitting there in that press conference is a good friend of mine and a researcher that I absolutely look up to is Dennis Fohl, who's also in the Olympic Project. That guy.
Yeah, I've heard good things about him.
Dennis is, yeah, you know, and, you know, you don't hear him or see him getting active or getting involved in drama, but I'll tell you what, that guy is a hell of a researcher. And very, very honest person, extremely intelligent. And so I just hope it all works out. You know, I'm out of that club. I've been kicked out, and that's fine. Because in light of everything, I'd kick myself out. But I don't know where it's going to go from here. It's really baffling.
Oh, really?
And no, I don't think I'm going to get any of my sample back. I would almost bet money the fact that I won't.
Yeah, I agree with you there. You're not going to get any samples back. And really, I think nothing's going to come of this, and it's a damn shame.
No.
That you know, the amount of effort and samples put forward are going to amount to nothing. Even if they are legit and had something to them, there's nothing to be found now because of the way these people have taken their actions and put forth to the scientific community. They're not respecting it, and it's kind of a joke now. Not just on the Facebook world or the YouTube world or the social media world, but in the scientific world, it's a damn shame, you know, and the fact that you probably will not see your samples back to get retested or what have you really sucks, to be honest.
Yeah, it does. It does indeed, but I think I'm going to win the lottery before I get that sample back, quite honestly. Yeah, you know, I don't like going out against anybody ever. I just really don't like doing that because I wouldn't appreciate it if people coming out against me. But that open letter to her that I put on Facebook was just, you know, and it, you know, I talked to Robin, I think, that night. I was just tired of, you know, just the secretiveness and the, holy shit, where's my sample? I asked for it 6 months ago. Why have I been ignored for 6 months? You know, so that's why
that's
I did
good
that.
You got a hold of her at least. At least you're open letter got their attention because.
Well, I didn't get a hold of Melba. I'm quite sure she won't speak to me at this point.
Well, Robin needs to make her own screen name.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah.
Robin needs to make her own screen name on those pages.
Yeah. So, anyways, were there more questions there on that?
All right. Well, we got another caller here.
Yeah, let's take them.
Okay. You're on Monster X Radio.
Hey, Shane, it's Thomas. How are you?
Hey, Thomas. That was John, but yeah. Hey, Thomas, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm good. Sorry about that, John. I wanted to ask Derek a question about those folks that go out for the first time. What are some of the things he would do as a first time out in the woods? And let me explain my situation. Being in Arkansas and, you know, growing up with the Boggy Creek Monster and all that stuff, I've been looking at the sightings that I can find online, and most of them show that the sightings are around the bottomland around here, which Arkansas is divided into mountains and then the delta, and in between them and down south are a lot of swamps. And I actually had it confirmed to me about a week or two ago of a sighting, a multitude number of sightings that haven't been reported in a certain part of the state, not too far from Little Rock, and would he suggest, instead of going out at night and doing like 2 or 3 days there, of going out and just kind of getting a survey of the land where these things are occurring and then scheduling to go back at a different time?
That's a great question. And here's how I would answer that. I would go out during the day, okay, because if you go out at night in an area like that, if you have an active area and you go out at night, what are you hoping for? You're hoping for what, like, Finding Bigfoot is hoping for. They're hoping for a reaction or a vocalization or a wood knock or something like that, and which is all cool and you know, entertaining, but that's that, you know, you just call it what it is. If you have interaction with one, that's cool. If that's what you're looking for, then great. Now, if you're going out trying to learn the area, learn more about the things that might inhabit this area, then you're going to want to go out in the daytime. And what I tell everybody, our clients, our hiking clients, whatever, is before you ever step foot into the wilderness, you got to do a couple different things. Number one, you got to be prepared. And with our expeditions up here, and this isn't an expedition commercial, but this will all tie in here in a second, but you got to be prepared to go out in the woods. You got to know your direction. You've got to have the proper clothing. You've got to know, you know, you got to be prepared if something happens to spend the night. So if my suggestion to you would be to get yourself prepared that way and then go out during the day and look for evidence. You know, find your water sources. Everything that's anywhere has to drink. So a water source is always a great place to find tracks and to find evidence of the different animals and the ungulates that are using the area. So get into the area, you know, get a map of it first and foremost. Get yourself a GPS and a compass. Make sure you're prepared. Go into the area. Take a notepad with you. And the first thing I would concentrate on is water sources. Once you figure out and pinpoint, document where the water sources are, then start looking at possible food, possible feeding areas. And just start, you know, surgically taking it apart that way. But the answer is easy. It's daytime.
Right. I'm a researcher by trade in another field. So as far as protocols and stuff, is what I haven't heard out of the Bigfoot community until I listened to you tonight. And I applaud you for that kind of stuff, because once again, this community needs that kind of stuff instead of like going out in the woods at night. The property that I'm looking at is actually on private land. And I've been invited, which I think is another big issue that folks need to, you know, have their P's and Q's, be nice to folks, and go out and make sure you have permission before you step over that fence post.
Definitely.
But, so I'm going to do that. I'm also going to, I've taken kids into the woods that have autism, so I know
cool.
about doing that preparedness stuff, especially with, now when I go looking for the water sources, it's so that the kids that I'm with won't jump in and take a swim in their clothing. But I totally believe, you know, if you look on the some of the sightings databases, you can actually see where the high concentrations of rainfall and water are in the United States, because that seems to trend to where a lot of these sightings occur. If you look right down the middle, there's, like, in the desert southwest and stuff like that, there may be a few, but there's not as much as there is down in the southeast, northeast, and then on the west coast where they get a lot of rain.
Right.
So, but, yeah, I'm gonna do that, and I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to go out there and survey it first, take some GPS data locations, and when I go back, I'm taking my GoPro and I'm going to stick it on top of my head so I don't miss anything.
Perfect. Perfect. I love it. That was a really good question.
Yeah,
Derek,
I know Thomas pretty well. I've talked to him for quite a while now, and Thomas is an awesome individual. I really respect that question there, Thomas. You know, it gets to the heart of Bigfooting, really, because I've been out with Derek before, and, you know, you get these TV shows like Finding Bigfoot, which I love. I mean, it is a TV show, and they're looking for ratings and all that, but they do have credible researchers on board. Thing is, to understand Finding Bigfoot, it's just that. It's a TV show.
Right.
Yeah, it's geared for the common folk, not the actual researcher, moneymaker.
Right.
Right, exactly. And, you know, people can learn a lot from these shows, but it is entertainment. And though the researchers are out there doing their thing, there's producers and whatnot there that have their motives, and they want ratings. So, I mean, they're going to go out at night because it raises the ratings.
Right.
And
spooky.
I'm a strong believer in the validity of science because I have to use it every day.
Yeah.
And to replicate something for it to occur again without being biased toward the subject is something, you know, that will eventually lend the validity that the outside world needs that doesn't, you know, participate in these type of discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if Derek could tell you how many TV shows he's turned down, you know, and I'm not bagging on anybody that's on one now, but Derek's turned down quite a few TV shows and appearances and whatnot, but Derek is strictly about the facts. And, you know, one thing I learned from him was, you know, daytime research is better than nighttime research. You're going to get maybe some sounds and some knocks and whatnot if you're in a good area. But really, to do research, you're not going to find much at night.
And who's to say that Bigfoots are truly nocturnal?
Right. Well, I don't think they're strictly nocturnal. I think they do move a lot at night, but they're obviously not just nocturnal. I mean, look at all the daytime sightings. I mean, they happen all the time.
Yeah,
well,
I don't think they could be sleeping.
If you wouldn't mind on this subject, and it's just kind of a little bit of his subject anyways. One thing that is real important, in my opinion, and through the Olympic Project, is if you're going to do effective research while you're out there during the daytime, and you probably already know this, the caller, but one thing I would like to say to people is just make yourself prepared. Do research on the area. Know your ins and outs. Know an escape route. Do your timing. You know, you want to make sure you can get out before dark. You want to make sure you're prepared because you cannot go out into the field and do effective research if you're, number one, scared, or number two, ill-prepared. If you're out there and you're self and set and secure and you know you've got everything you could possibly need in your backpack to survive if you twist a leg or whatever, then you're out there and you're comfortable, and then you're going to be able to do the effective research. You're going to be more observant, and you're going to be able to learn more things. But if you're not prepared, then you're going to be worried about being prepared while you're out there, and it's just going to take away from your whole, you know, research experience. So I know it's kind of not really where your question was, but I think that's part of it as well.
I think that's extremely important, and that kind of goes back to what I do as a researcher, is that when I have my individuals that I'm working with, I want to reduce their anxiety so much that they don't have to focus on that anymore. All they can focus on is the actual experience. So, well, listen, Derek, I appreciate you taking my call. I appreciate what you do in the community, and I will be definitely following the Olympic Project.
Well, it was really nice talking to you.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas.
See you later, buddy.
All right.
Well, speaking of projects, Derek, I know you're also involved with the Falcon Project. You know, we've had William Barnes on the show before talking about it, and your name was brought up. And what exactly, what role do you play in the Falcon Project, you know, if it finally, and I do believe it will, but it takes time like anything else to get off the ground?
Sure. What Jeff Elderman and William approached me and asked if I would like to put together a ground response team for whatever they might find. And what it entails is if this thing is flying, and I'm guessing it's just in the northwest here that they're going to be using me. I certainly, in a voluntary status, can't go all the way all over the country following this thing around.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they're on the north, if they're in the northwest here, and what the Olympic Project role is going to be is going to be if the ship is up and it's flying and it spots something on the ground that appears to be a Sasquatch, and then they're going to obviously record it and follow it as much as they can. And then once it leaves their view, then the bat phone rings, and we've got a team that's on the ready, and we get to that location as soon as humanly possible. They give us GPS coordinates, and we hike in. And we hike in not to go chase it, but to go gather what evidence that it may have left behind. And so they've just asked me to come in and organize a team that can do that, a quick response thing, and it's strictly voluntary. But, yeah, I said, hell yeah, that sounds like a blast.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like a good
time
and another excuse to go hiking. So that's what we're doing
with them. Yeah, if he's in the Oregon area, I'm going to jump on board and head out there, too, likewise.
Yeah, I would.
Believe it or not, Jeff is going to be part of the ground team whenever he can as well. A lot of people don't know this about Jeff, but he's a pretty good woodsman. He's pretty comfortable out there.
Yeah.
So it should be a blast. You know, to me, the Falcon Project, you know, it's the science is being handled by the science guys. Our part that we've been asked to do is kind of what we do. So it's hand in glove, and it just actually sounds like a lot of fun. So I hope that they get their funding because I would love to be part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait for it to lift off. Yeah, I hope they get the funding, too. I mean, I really think it's going in the right area as far as research is concerned. The amount of what William Barnes has done, I mean, he's done his homework, and he talked about someone who has spent sleepless nights trying to get this thing off the ground. You know, he just needs the funding. He's done his homework and whatnot, and he just needs the funding. And he's slowly getting there, but, you know, people are impatient, of course, as usual, and they want this thing off the ground.
And
right
not
away.
Everybody agrees with the concept as well.
No,
you know?
Of course not.
But the funny thing is, I won't mention any names, but there's a couple of researchers that have thrown big rocks at it, and then the next day they're out in the field tracking.
They say
it's an invasion of privacy, but the next day they're out in the field following up on a track line, and there's really no difference. I mean, as far as being invasive, you don't get much, you know, less invasive than flying over something in a quiet ship and filming from above. So I think that argument is ridiculous. It's got its detractors, and that's one of the reasons it probably hasn't obtained all of its funding yet. But I'm just sitting back and waiting, and hopefully it does get its funding, and if it does, then we're ready to rock and roll. I think it will just be cool.
Yeah.
It'll be awesome.
Yeah.
You got to have new innovative ways.
Our travel and stuff.
Yeah.
So that'll take a little bit of the bite out of it. But anyways,
I approached
William afterwards and said, hey, you know, it'd be really cool. It would be to get a vehicle put together to where all of our gear is packed in it. And, you know, just a quick response vehicle. So, you know, the key's in the ignition. So all we have to do when the time comes is turn the key and haul ass. And that's pretty much, I think, what we're going to end up doing if this gets off the ground. It's just having, you know, an SUV, preferably like a four-wheel drive SUV, with all the necessary gear on the ready. So we get a phone call, we can just move, you know.
Yeah, without trying to pack up everything and missing an opportunity to gather information. That's fantastic. I haven't heard that idea yet. That's awesome.
Well, it's an idea that costs money. You know, you've got to get the thing built before we start talking about the ins and outs and the intricacies of their plan. But I think that would be the most effective way to do it and just be ready to go. That way we could be on site, you know, here at least in the Pacific Northwest, up and down and through Oregon, you know, within maybe 8 to 10 hours, you know, wherever it might be. And there's another misperception about the Falcon Project, and I'll just throw my opinion out there about things that we're talking about it. A lot of people are saying it's not going to see through the forest canopy. And in some situations, no, it won't. But what a lot of people don't realize is up here in the Pacific Northwest, one of the biggest areas that's most common for finding tracks are in a lot of open areas. You know, you've got these big river basins up here. You've got the Salduck. You've got the Ho River. You've got the Queets River, the Quinault River. When the elk are calving in April and May, tracks start showing up in these river basins. Well, the majority of these river basins are open. And you can fly right over top and film right down on them. And, I mean, huge expanses of open ground where the rivers run through because the rivers run wide. They have several little, you know, tributaries that come in and out. But the river basins, like the Queets, is a perfect example. If you were to, you know, Google Earth the Queets River and the Quinault River, you can zoom down and you can see these massive expanses of open river basin. And then also up here in the Olympics, there's a lot of, you know, big meadowy areas. You know, so the argument of it'll be worthless because it can't see through the canopy is really not a argument that holds any weight. So, anyways, just my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, we need to try new things because what we're doing right now, you know, hasn't produced the results we're ultimately looking for.
Correct, Armando.
I don't see how someone can be against that. And don't you have something else coming up here in November you're going to be speaking at a Sasquatch Summit?
Yeah, there's a – I don't know a whole lot about it. It's the Sasquatch Summit. It's I think it's being held at Lake Quinault Resort Lodge there,
yes,
which is pretty close to our research area. And I think Dr. Meldrum's going to be speaking there as well. And let's see who else. Scott.
Well, I can tell you.
Okay.
Phil Poling,
mm-hmm,
Ron Moorhead, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, and who else?
Scott Taylor?
Yeah, Scott Taylor, yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
yeah, so I believe it's going to be a lot of fun. I kicked around the idea with him. He was going to do some promotional things. And one of the things that we talked about was people were going to raffle in or something to go for a guided hike with us. But I'm not sure if that's going to happen yet. But it sounds like a fun event. So looking forward to that one. And that's a really cool place, the Quinault Resort. So hope a lot of people show up. Should be a really fun event.
Oh, you can guarantee I'll be there.
I'm sorry?
I said you can guarantee I'll be there. I think Guy Edwards is going to help promote this and be a part of it as well, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, and that would be great. Guy is phenomenal.
He is. He's phenomenal. No, I
you
think,
guys are lucky. You got all the fun stuff out there.
Well,
we do live in a good spot for this stuff. That is,
yes,
for sure.
Absolutely. You know, I'm looking forward to the Sasquatch Summit because some of the speakers are going to be there. You know, I met most of them or talked to most of them, but, you know, just being around folks like this, you know, Derek and, you know, Scott and Phil and these sort of guys, you know, even Meldrum, you know, you learn so much and they're so personable. You know, they're not, you know, everybody gives this thing, this persona to Bigfooters that they have a hierarchy and this fame sort of thing, but all these guys are just down to earth, just awesome individuals that, you know, that will sit down and talk with you one-on-one just about Bigfoot or whatever, you know, and that's the one thing I love about some of these events.
Yeah, the events are cool in the Bigfoot world because everybody's right there and accessible. And, yeah, there is, in my opinion, there is no hierarchy in Bigfoot research. That's funny because in the dialogue,
yeah,
going back and forth between Scott Carpenter and I yesterday,
mm-hmm,
he made mention of the fact of the Bigfoot Mafia, I think, pertaining to myself and Bart and,
yeah,
a few others. And I just, I belly laughed for about 5 minutes. He's like, really? You know, we're all Bigfoot researchers. Think about that word. You know, the general,
yeah,
public, most of them think we're crazy to start with.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's any hierarchy here. It's just a bunch of, you know, like-minded people. And, you know, quite frankly, Bigfoot research is fantastic, but if I'm going to choose between deer hunting and Bigfoot, Bigfoot's going to lose. You know, you got to keep your life and your hobbies in perspective.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a field of research. It's just weird. I was talking to somebody the other day, 15 years ago, Bigfoot research was so much fun and zero drama. No drama, no blogs, no bullshit, no he said, she said, just all the crap that ensues today. It was just fun. It was just, nobody even cared. You know, we're just out doing it, and once in a while you'd see an episode on In Search Of or something.
Yeah.
But today it's gotten complicated and screwy, and it actually, you know, I've thought about several times here recently, actually, about just stepping out of it, just because of the dramatic, you know, end of it and all the crazy,
yeah,
attitudes out there. It's just almost not worth it. Yeah, you know, just I'd still do my research, but I would just, you know, kind of go off the radar and not really talk to anybody anymore.
Well, Derek, please do not do that. I know that your name gets dragged in the mud as well as some of the best. And like we touched upon earlier, you know, Bart's name gets dragged in the mud. Cliff's name gets dragged in the mud. You know, I mean, all these guys that I respect, that I know personally, you know, they get dragged in the mud, and it's because they, you know, they do make comments or provide a little bit of evidence or their two cents on these,
uh-huh,
social media sites, you know, and I would hate to see you guys drop off the face. You know, I know we'll maintain contact, but there are so many people out there that support you, that support what you're doing, support some of the other guys out there, what they're doing. The ones that they put their two cents in really are just, armchair quarterbacks jump on Facebook or computers and they're like, oh, this and that. They really don't get out there. They just don't. And
right,
it's a shame because if they did, they might learn something. Or if they actually went out to the Olympic Project, per se, they might actually come away with, you know, an awe or at least respect for what we're, you know, trying to do here.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. You got a great point. Yeah, it just it gets disillusioning after a while.
No, I agree.
You get tired of it. But that being said, there's so much positive to it. You know, like, well, you were there. You know, you get a big room full of like-minded people that all get to go out in the woods together. It's a freaking blast.
It's a bitchin'
time. It's a good time. And
yeah.
You just got to kind of remind yourself. You got to make more of those times. And so you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
I just get fed up from time to time, especially lately. It's just been like one thing after another.
Well, yeah. I mean, especially recently with the whole Melba thing and the Dyer thing and everything else. It's just, I get, you know, fortunately, I'm not there where you're at, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't get the hate and the negativity of it all. You know, I could post something and don't get that sort of thing, but, you know, like I said, a lot of people respect what you're doing. In fact, I can speak for most that have joined us tonight that, you know, they respect you and they love listening to you, and we have a big show, I mean, big crowd tonight that, you know, they're just listening. They're feeding on the words that you say because you're respected and they respect you. And, you know, that's just where we're at, you know.
Right on, Shane.
Yeah,
I really appreciate that.
I don't respect many people. You know that, Shane. And Derek's definitely one of the top-notch guys in the field. And you're right. There is a lot of negativity, but there's a lot of positivity. It's a great way to share resources, to connect with people, to, you know, advertise for your expeditions and the Olympic Project and whatnot.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, you know, I've been out with Derek before. I can vouch for, personally, what an honest guy the guy is and how, you know, Derek lent me FLIR camera, you know. We were at Cliff's house, and we were talking about my research area, and I said, you know, I'd love to have a FLIR to go out to my area. And he's like, oh, hold on a second. He runs out to his truck and grabs me a FLIR camera and hands it to me. He says, hey, here you go. You know, and I was just blown away. I was dumbfounded at this because right now I can't afford my own FLIR. I hope to because I think I could provide some good evidence and stuff down the road here in my research area. But he just grabbed it from his truck and gave it to me, you know. And I was seriously just, like, dumbfounded. The man, you, Derek, are just such a blessing to the Bigfoot community and as a whole, and you're so honest and just the type of guy that, like I said, when I went to the Olympic Project, I could, you know, we were sitting down eating breakfast and just talking Bigfoot. I was talking Bigfoot with Jeff Meldrum, Cliff Brockman, and all these guys, and, you know, people give them such a bad persona that it blows my mind because they have never actually dealt with these guys in person. You know, they just...
Derek and Jeff do pretty good in the online community.
No, they do.
They fare better than most.
Oh, way better than most because of, you know, how they go about their business. Yes.
Yeah. But you're right.
Well,
it's always going to be haters.
There is.
Yeah.
There is. You know, and one day... You know, we're all in this surge, and one day maybe maybe it'll change a little bit for the positive once the verification comes through and the world finally realizes that these things are real.
Definitely.
You know, it's going to be really interesting to see what a post-discovery research world was going to look like. You know, then what are we going to fight about then, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be the main topic at that point.
People are just hungry. They want something. They want to see something real. You know, it's been a long time since the Patterson footage, and we haven't had anything.
That's a great point. That is a great point. And it's just that's the thing though that makes Bigfoot research so intriguing to me is that it's such a tall order. I mean, it is the ultimate challenge.
It is the ultimate challenge, and when you put yourself out there, you're looking for a world of hate, but that's not why we do this. It's not why we go out there and do it. It's because we know Sasquatch to exist. You know, it's not just a passion, but it's a belief. And, you know, you put yourself, especially you, Derek, and some of the other guys like Bart and whatnot, put yourself in a situation where you're going to get blasted conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and
well, if you're connected to anything that's going on, you're going to get blasted.
Yeah.
One direction or another, you know, and then, you know, to some of the emails I get, you know, I get a lot of really positive, supportive emails. Like I said, I get a lot of people bitching at me because I haven't updated the Olympic Project website, but hopefully I've explained myself good enough about that.
Yeah.
But just this association, you know, with Justin and with the fact that I know Rick and this different stuff, some people are just, oh, my God, some of these emails, you'll
I
burn in hell, mister, and all this different stuff. Just got to sit back and go, wow, is deer hunting season here yet,
yeah.
You know?
I'm able to accept that kind of stuff. I mean, no one's going to agree with someone 100%. I mean, while I have my questions about the whole Justin thing, I don't think any less of you because you're investigating and following through with it. I mean, I think that's what we need to do because if there is a shred of hope or reality to it all, someone's got to look into it.
Sure. And, you know, the fact is, why not? You know, what's the harm?
Yeah, that,
you know,
yeah.
Is there any harm? You know, with Justin, it was a different situation because I was the first investigator to talk to Justin, or maybe second after Tyler Huggins, but I talked to Justin, and it was I had to really beat myself up and give it a lot of soul searching before I decided if I wanted to work with him or not. And then when I talked to him in depth again and again and again, and we recovered the story and over and over and over again, it started dawning on me this guy wasn't telling a lie. And the whole story, you know, made me upset. But upset or not, it still is what it is. You know, you're a Bigfoot researcher and you want to get to the bottom of stuff. And so you choose to get involved. And just the fact that I got involved with him after his horrific story, you know, had a lot of people, you know, throwing me under the bus. But that kind of stuff doesn't even bother me. I don't even care.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to do this, you got to take the good, the bad, and the ugly. You got to try to pick your way through the middle of it and learn. Basically, the key is just to learn as much as you can from everybody you encounter in this field and every witness that you encounter. So, I don't know. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. It's all good.
Yeah.
It's going to be
you,
done here
sure.
soon, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Derek, do you have anything planned with Justin or Bart down the road here?
I would like to go spend some more time up to Killsite,
sure.
I know Bart's been going up there as much as humanly possible. I spent 4 days there, 3 days or 4 days there, and I hiked. I said this in an interview before, and somebody changed it to 500 miles. But I hiked probably in those days, I would say, you know, between 30 to 40 miles, maybe even 50. I don't know. I hiked all day, every day.
Yeah.
And I so enjoyed myself there. It was different from where I'm at. And it was just beautiful. And I would love to go spend some time there and to do some research there and look around. It's a very unique spot. There's three or four different river drainages that come off of this knob. And they're all just absolutely beautiful. And very, what's the word? What's Matt Moneymakers? Very squatchy. Squatchy looking area. And
there's
a ton of bear there, a ton of wildlife. And I would very much plan and hope to get back there sometime in the spring or summer with Bart and Justin. Not only that,
nice.
But we hooked Justin up with some cameras, and he's got some cameras up in the area. Love to go down and maybe put a couple more and so on and
so
forth.
I have personally spent some time in that, not the Killsite area, but in that general area before, and it, like you said, Matt Moneymaker's words are, it's very squatchy. The area is beautiful. I mean, a lot of it's high desert sort of thing, coniferous and whatnot, but beautiful area with an abundance of wildlife, you know, great area. Yeah.
And we went at a time of year, I think, when you know, the meadows were green and lush, and God, it's just gorgeous, man.
Yeah.
Just a gorgeous place.
You know,
go ahead.
Well, I guess we only have a couple minutes left here, but I was just wondering, you know how you said they're really rare, Bigfoot? Someone asked earlier in the chat room, you know, do you have a rough guess of how many you think are in the United States?
United States, I have no idea. I'll tell you, Washington State, it's just nothing but a guess, and I'm probably way wrong. Well, I'll start with the Olympics, where I do my research. I would be willing to bet, in my opinion only, that there could be anywhere from 30 to 100, probably 30 or 40, 50 in the Olympics total. Washington State, if I was going to guess, and a lot of your top researchers disagree with me on this. They think there's more. I don't. If I was going to guess in Washington State between the Cascades and the Olympics, I would say maybe 100, maybe 110. I just don't think they're as big as everybody thinks they are. I really don't. I think that they cover a lot of territory. They cover a lot of ground. And I could even be high with my numbers. You know, there could be as few as 20 or 30 in the Olympics. But I don't think that there's nearly as many as a lot of researchers think there are.
Yeah, I agree.
United States-wide, not a clue.
Yeah, United States-wide, we don't get out to all these other states. But up here, I agree. It's not as big a number as some of these guys say. You know, I mean, if it was, Bigfoot would be on a slab. It would be proven
exactly.
To exist. Yeah, period.
The game would be over.
The game would be over. Yeah.
Well, it's just amazing that we have a breeding population that is big enough to sustain them, yet they're rare enough to remain undiscovered,
right.
You know?
Well, in my opinion, and again, just a screwed-up opinion, probably wrong, I think that they are on their way out. You know, I don't think that...
I would agree with that. I've actually started thinking that myself recently.
Mm-hmm. So I think that that's just the way it is. Could be wrong, but... I, myself, and a lot of people I work with and a lot of people I know spend an ungodly amount of time in the forest.
Yeah.
And we do cover a lot of areas. Again, you know, these things are so much your superior in the woods that it is impossible to even come up with an accurate guess. But I just think if there were that many of them running around that one would have been hit by a logging truck or more hunters would have taken them out. I just don't think there's that many of them left.
Well,
Derek,
thanks for joining us, Derek.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, Derek. You know, you're standing up in my book, and I really appreciate you joining us. And, you're a friend of mine, and I really appreciate you joining us and giving us your two cents, man.
Well, man, I really enjoyed this talk, you guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you.
Awesome, Derek. Look forward to the future.
All right, man. You guys take care.
You too, Derek.
You too, bud.
Thanks.
And thanks, everyone in the chat room, for joining us. We'll see you next week.